You know, here at WSLR, when the commitment is made to public service, that's certainly expressed in the No Nonsense Nutrition Program. And so this is definitely one you want to get your pens and pencils out, because I'm going to welcome my guest, Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, geriatrician, and member of the American Board of Holistic Medicine. Welcome to the show this morning, Dr. Harvey.
Good morning.
You know, hormones are messengers. They're signaling devices. They get manufactured in one part of the body and they get sent to another part of the body to tell that part of the body how to behave. Every single hormone in your body is a protein. It's made out of the amino acids that you eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And those hormones essentially run our life. They run our cells. They tell a whole host of functions in our body exactly how to behave. So if you've ever experienced fatigue, you know, fatigue is probably the single biggest complaint that I get presenting to me in my practice. If you've ever been somebody who's been worried about breast cancer or some other reproductive organ cancer, if you're an individual who's concerned about the huge increase in diabetes, that combination of diabetes and obesity that we're seeing in this country. If it's ever been a time that your thyroid hasn't been working right, then you want to learn more about hormones. And Dr. Harvey and I are here today to talk about those very things.
Hormones are really very powerful things. The Greek meaning of the word is a force that makes something happen or to make it happen faster. These regulatory biochemicals are produced in every multicellular organism. The major role is to provide inter-organ and intercellular communication. So these are signaling molecules that tell a story. They're manufactured in glands and groups of specialized cells that are designed specifically to manufacture and then distribute these hormones from the to communicate through the system. Adrenal glands, pituitary glands, thyroid, pancreas, parathyroid, testicles, ovaries, all these are glands. And they regulate the physiologic and behavioral activities. They control, they adjust, they maintain order. It's a really complex system. And it really is very delicately balanced between all these glands.
Well, I think everybody has seen the picture that comes to us often from India of what are called the chakras, or the energy centers of the body. And it's really interesting that all seven of those chakras correspond with one of these endocrine glands, because these secretory glands that are squirting out these magic essences that we call hormones are incredibly delicate. And it's not just a matter of how much hormone you're making. It's a matter of how much hormone you're using and how much hormone you're getting rid of. Because your body has to get that hormone attached to a receptor site, allow it to signal the activity that it regulates, and then the body has to, like it does with so many things, rip it up and throw it away.
I love the way the functional medicine group talks about how complex this system gets. It gets quite stressful when you look at a steroidogenic pathway, when you take cholesterol and transform it into every one of our sex hormones, starting with pregnenolone and going on to estriol as the very end excretory hormone. It's so complex, they've decided to use a stress term to describe it, PTSD. Production, transport, sensitivity, and detoxification and elimination. So there's places all along these different areas where we can have disruption of the normal function of the hormones in production, synthesis, and secretion, in transport, getting it to the organ or to the target organ, sensitivity, whether the organ can hear the signal of it, and detoxification, whether these things hang around too long and whether we can get rid of them.
Well, and you know, with the popularizing of hormonal therapy, you know, I think of Suzanne Summers out there, you know, hustling her books and her non-medical ideas about hormones being the fountain of youth. But you know, what's really true is that there's a reason that Mother Nature says we shouldn't have the same amount of hormones at age 60 that we had at age 30. And so a lot of these physicians and other clinicians that talk about anti-aging, I mean, talk about an oxymoron word, anti-aging, that means you're dead. You can't age anymore. Aging youthfully is probably a better choice, or aging slowly is probably a better choice. And so we know we want those hormones to work. But, you know, we've given too much assignment to what these hormones actually do, and not enough understanding of the fact that how much we produce, how we transport them, how sensitive we are to utilizing them, and what things get in the way of doing that. And the things that get in the way are the things that we call endocrine disruptors.
Endocrine disruptors chemicals that come from outside the body. To put it in perspective with what's going on inside the body, though, I was thinking about an analogy to describe how specifically potent these things are. If you think of a teaspoon of water, that's 5 grams or 5 milliliters. A teaspoon of salt is going to be a little less than that, because the spaces between all the pieces of solid will make it a little bit less dense. So maybe 4.5 grams of salt in a teaspoon. Is that about right, Eve?
Yeah.
So if you think about grams, and then you think about dividing that into the units of measurement that we use to look at hormones in the system, in a 2 teaspoon amount of blood, it's likely, when you divide this, to take the salt, there's lots of grains of salt in there. But when you look at that, it's a 5-gram amount. If you divide that into smaller amounts, milligrams, you've got 5,000 milligrams. But we don't even look at hormones in milligrams. We go smaller. Micrograms is the first place we start looking at hormone doses or levels in the blood. And so that's a millionth of, or 5 million grains or micrograms in that teaspoon of salt. But we even go lower than that. Nanograms. There'd be 5 billion nanograms in that teaspoon of salt. And so in a teaspoon or 2 teaspoons of blood, we might have 0.5 grain or maybe a whole grain of that salt distributed between 2 teaspoons of blood of quantity of hormone to actually have effect in the body. Billions and billions of tiny little pieces of it.
And so that's one of the reasons that we have so much respect for hormones. A lot of times people say, oh, I'm feeling fatigue, I'm going to take some DHEA. My thyroid is down, so I'm going to take some extra thyroid hormone. They don't understand they're messing with an incredibly delicate mechanism. And that's the reason that environmental things that act like hormones are really a potential troublemaker. We know now that these endocrine disruptors that we have in the environment, whether they be pesticides, whether they be plastics, whether they be other toxic chemicals or heavy metals, all of them collectively can affect how our hormones work. So it's not just whether you have too little or too much hormone. It's not just whether your receptor site will use it correctly. It's not just whether your body is going to metabolize it and excrete it correctly. It's also you're fighting all of the toxins that we have in the environment that are hormone-like in their nature. And we can start right away with talking about BPA, the compound that is used in the manufacture of plastic in order to keep it soft, the compound that is in the lining of soup cans. I found a study yesterday that showed that individuals who drank 12 ounces or 8 12-ounce of vegetable soup out of the can every day for 5 days, compared to individuals who ate 12 ounces of vegetable soup that had been made fresh. And so they took all these individuals and they measured the BPA, this chemical that we have in plastic bottles and children's toys in plastic cups. And they measured everybody before they started the test, and they found BPA detected some amount in 77% of all the urine samples that were taken after the fresh soup was consumed. But 100% of the people put BPA out in their urine when they were consuming vegetable soup out of a can. But the thing that was astounding was the amount of BPA from the canned soup eaters increased 1,221%. And so BPA has been known to be an endocrine disruptor. And how are we going to avoid it? Well, first off, think twice before you put plastic in a microwave. Think twice before you put anything hot into a plastic container, and make sure that you're not buying any bottles that have the number 7 in the triangle underneath the bottle, the one that says that it, you know, it's potentially recyclable. You don't want to see a 7 there, even if it says BPA free.
Who hasn't had canned food? I don't know of anybody who hasn't. And when they do studies, they've shown that at least 93% of Americans have BPA in their systems. The reason this is so important is that it has been linked to disrupting endocrine systems and causing relating to cause in breast cancer, other reproductive cancers, or early puberty, and potentially heart disease. The mechanism of action of these is not specifically known, but if you think about the complexity of the way the hormone signaling occurs in the body, the cells respond in very interesting ways. Breast cells, for example, they have estrogen and progesterone receptors, so they have ears to listen for the signal of these hormones. When the breast cell hears the signal of estrogen. So if the ovary secretes estrogen and it comes through the body, through the transport, through the circulation, and lands on a breast cell, and the receptor hears that signal, inside the cell, the nucleus makes changes and starts producing other things and doing other actions. One of the things it does is it increases the synthesis of progesterone receptors. So the breast hearing the signal of estrogen will make more progesterone receptors so it can hear the signal of progesterone. Why is that? The reason is that breast responds to estrogen by growing, and it responds to progesterone by stopping growing. In fact, progesterone has the unique ability of causing something called apoptosis, or pre-programmed cell death. It will actually tell the cells to die. And that's what happens in the menstrual cycle. At the end of the cycle, after the estrogen has caused the lining of the uterus to grow, the progesterone tells it to stop growing and slough and go away. So the progesterone receptor, when the breast hears that signal, it will actually decrease the production of estrogen receptors. So it will hear less of that signal and actually stop growing. It's a combination effect. So they're very complex cross-talking situations here.
Well, you know, when you talk about estrogen, there's a whole lot of women who think that as soon as they get close to menopause and they start having hot flashes, that they ought to go on estrogen. They ought to take that extra estrogen. And we found out very quickly after the book Feminine Forever came out at the end of the 1950s that women that took estrogen all by itself ended up with a whole lot more cancers of the uterus. So it was interesting that yesterday's Sunday paper has the parade section in it, and one of the advertisements that was in the parade section was the advertisement for Premarin, a drug that is commonly used to support estrogen and is given often to women who have hot flashes during their menopause. It also treats vaginal changes that happen during menopause. But what was interesting was that the half a page of promotion about why you should take Premarin was followed by two full columns of all of the dangers. But it was interesting to read the possible side effects of taking this conjugated estrogen. Heart attack, stroke, blood clots, dementia, breast cancer, cancer of the lining of the uterus, ovarian cancer, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, gallbladder disease, liver problem, enlargement of benign tumors, severe allergic reactions. Call your healthcare provider if you get breast lumps, vaginal bleeding, changes in speech, new severe headaches, severe pains in your chest, shortness of breath, weakness, fatigue, swollen tongue, lips, or face. The list was unbelievable to read. I mean, all you'd have to do is read that list and go, why in the world would anybody want to take conjugated estrogen. Well, any woman that's gone through the dreadful zone of hot flashes knows exactly why they want to be taking estrogen, to try to relieve the sleeplessness that comes from having hot flashes during the night. But the real question is, when we're talking about a little dabble, do you, what happens if we put estrogen in that isn't exactly like the estrogen that women make? Remember, there's a foundational rule in chemistry, and that is you change the shape of a molecule, you change the function of a molecule. So when you change estrogen into conjugated estrogen, it's sort of kind of like it, but not exactly like it.
Yes, that's the real key. These are very potent signaling molecules, and when you use Premarin, it's equine estrogen. It comes from a horse. It's not quite like human estrogen.
So, you know, somebody thinks that a 1,000-pound animal has the exact same kind of estrogen that a woman does.
So when you put these exogenous chemicals, these things that were created outside the human body, into the body, and you start having these things talk, you get into some trouble. So the equine estrogen is shown to cause about an 8-fold increase in your risk of breast cancer. It's even known, that human estrogen can increase the risk of breast cancer. It's about a 2-fold increase, or 1.5 times, but it's still there. It's because of one of the issues that we talked about earlier, PTSD, detoxification. If you take even hormones, human hormones, bioidentical, and I just got into a real interesting discussion a couple days ago with a local pharmacist who told one of my patients that their bioidentical compounded hormone was natural because it came from wild yam. And though in essence that might be true, all hormones that we use that are synthesized for bioidentical use come from a natural source to begin with, like the extract of wild yam or the extract of soybean. But these are changed in the lab to look exactly like human hormones, because the plant kingdom does not make human hormones. It just doesn't happen. And so we have to take their chemicals that look like our chemicals and in the lab make them bioidentical, which means looking exactly like and functioning exactly like the human hormone, because they are the identical biochemical. But these even have risk when we detoxify them inappropriately, because estrogen can actually go through the liver and be converted into something called a quinolated estrogen, which is a very toxic carcinogenic compound. And with proper detoxification, we don't get so much of that.
When we look at detoxifying hormones in the body, we're going to run right away over to our good old friend, the cabbage family. Every time we eat coleslaw, broccoli, cauliflower, bok choy, arugula, watercress, when we have kale, all of these foods contain compounds that help us get hormones out of the body. I have clients in my practice, and on the fourth week of their menstrual cycle, I encourage them to have coleslaw every day for lunch and eat broccoli or one of those other vegetables, including Brussels sprouts, every night for dinner. Because simply by getting these compounds in from the cabbage family, the body does a better job of detoxifying hormones, or letting them do what they're supposed to do, and then getting them out of the body. We want the hormones to be produced. And so sometimes people don't produce enough hormones. And that's where they begin to take supplemental hormones, as is common in thyroid insufficiency.
Yes, thyroid insufficiency is another one that can be produced or promoted by some of these environmental chemicals. Perchlorates are present everywhere in the water. Perchlorates are rocket fuel, basically. And it's become very prevalent in the environment. It's in the water, and it's very difficult to avoid it.
Wait a minute. We don't have any rockets going off in Sarasota.
This is true, but we've used this chemical industrially so much that it's become prevalent throughout our entire environment.
Well, and we've talked so many times here on No Nonsense Nutrition about the fact that we need to get an absolute 1 micron water filter at our faucet. While it's true that reverse osmosis does take some of these compounds out, or the majority of these compounds out, I'm personally not a fan of reverse osmosis because you have to throw away a gallon of water for every gallon of water that you use. And secondly, I found out in my practice that a lot of people that have an RO system or a reverse osmosis system don't do a very good job of the maintenance of the diaphragms inside the unit. And as a result, it may not actually be removing all of these toxic things like perchlorates. What we want to do, though, is to make sure that when we buy a water filter, that it's not granulated carbon, doesn't have silver in it, or isn't so small, like one of those things that you screw on a faucet or hook to a water pitcher, that the only thing that it can do is take out really large molecules. Granted, it will reduce the lead that's in there, another one of the endocrine disruptors, but it won't deal with some of these smaller molecules if the size of the filter is not significant enough. You know, those things you screw on the faucet or you hook to a water pitcher, those filters are only the size of a charcoal briquette. They just don't have enough surface area to really remove those compounds. But when we're talking about stuff like rocket fuel, perchlorate, which is heavily contaminated in the water down around Miami, the nature of removing that, we're going to protect ourselves if we have a diet that is high in iodine. Now, you should have at least 150 micrograms of iodine in your high-quality multivitamin. But when you eat foods that contain iodine, like lettuce that grows under the sea, what you know is seaweed, whether you sprinkle some nori on top of your brown rice or you eat a piece of sushi that's wrapped up in nori or you eat some seaweed salad, wakame, arami, any of the seaweeds, you're going to get good sources of iodine in your diet. Even sprinkling some kelp on your food instead of using salt is one of the ways that you can help protect your thyroid from the damaging effect of compounds like perchlorate.
So the there are so many other ones. Think about the pesticides, organochlorine pesticides, and they're everywhere in our environment. Atrazine is one of the worst. Atrazine's been linked to the diabetes epidemic. It's used extensively throughout the Midwest, very extensively, and it's very prevalent in the water. So again, a carbon block filter to remove as much of that as possible. I like even to put one of those small ones on my shower just to reduce chlorine and lead coming out of the shower head. So the there are several other very potent disruptors that are very prevalent. Mercury is one of them. Mercury is associated with so many disruptive processes in the body. It's been shown to, I'm sure somebody out there has thought or read about or been told that they have adrenal fatigue. Well, that could be mercury. Mercury interferes with the manufacture of your cortisol and your other steroid hormones because it interferes with one of the enzymes. Mercury is a vicious attacker. It reminds me of the liquid Terminator on the second or third Terminator movie that could just turn into liquid and transform into another form. Mercury's like that. It will seep into your body. When I was at one of my first heavy metal detoxification seminars, one of the teachers told a story of one of his colleagues who was doing mercury research, and this woman had a drop of ethyl mercury. Think of ethyl mercury as being gasoline mixed with mercury. And so one drop of this stuff touched her latex glove, but it's a solvent like acetone. It went right through the glove and into her. One drop. And in 6 months, she was dead. It unraveled her brain. Ethyl mercury is what's found in the flesh of fatty fish like tuna. And so one way to reduce your exposure to mercury is to really reduce your exposure to those cold, oily, big fish.
Well, we want to remember there's five fish the World Health Organization says are toxic at a single dose, and our greatest concern is for pregnant and nursing mothers. So, you know, if you're going to eat tuna fish at all, make it infrequently, but make sure it's light tuna, not white tuna. You don't ever want to eat king mackerel or shark or swordfish or tilefish. And the sushi tuna that everybody is so fond of, you have to realize we have very few of these large fishes left. These bluefin and yellowfin tuna, they're big fish. They're high up on the food chain. And so when we talk about fish like swordfish or shark or tuna, we're not talking about little tiny fish. We're talking about really, really big fish. And so mercury moves up the food chain. And as we realize that the sushi could be hazardous to your health, all of a sudden it isn't going to be so appealing to you. Mercury can show up in not only the amalgam fillings that you have in your mouth, but on your dinner plate. And so to reduce your exposure by avoiding those five fishes is an important piece. You know, salmon, farm-raised trout, you know, they're some of the safer fishes that we can take in. But my rule with fish is if I ate grouper this week, don't eat grouper again. If I ate snapper this week, don't eat snapper again. Keep rotating your species, and you're going to reduce the risk of mercury exposure. But mercury is not the only one of the heavy metals that acts as an endocrine disruptor. We had already mentioned lead, certainly a heavy metal that you can avoid, but also arsenic. You know, on the EWG site, and we've endorsed so many times on the air the Environmental Working Group, because the Environmental Working Group is doing a really stellar job to bring information to you about how you can do a good job not only to protect yourself, but to protect the planet. And they put arsenic in the list of the top dozen endocrine disruptors. You know, we think about arsenic, we think about murder mysteries. But in fact, we've seen arsenic contamination increase in the human population. Dr. Harvey and I have both seen this in our practices because, unfortunately, about 74% of all of the chicken feed that the FDA allows to be sold has got arsenic in it. And you go, what? How in heaven's name could you possibly put arsenic in the chicken feed? Well, little tiny bits of arsenic can assist in keeping the chickens free of parasites. So unless you're buying organic chicken, you're going to be getting a chicken that has been fed a collection of genetically modified corn with a little bit of arsenic thrown in for flavor. And this is how some of the arsenic is getting into our bodies. It's not just a matter of putting a filter on your faucet. It's a matter of looking at buying organic chickens. Remember, we want to eat less meat but higher quality. So when people say, I can't afford a $10 chicken, well, the circumstances are we just need to be eating less of it.
Another surprising place that arsenic shows up in our food chain is really unlikely. But if you think about the nature of economics, cotton was grown over much of the world. Arsenic was used for a pesticide against the boll weevil. And now rice is being grown on many former cotton fields. Rice is a very significant source of arsenic potential toxicity. So areas like East Asia, Texas, and Arkansas and Alabama that grew a lot of cotton, those are questionable rices unless they're stated to be organic. We need to look at that. It's also in a lot of the water supply. So again, back to the water filter to prevent that. Even mentioned BPA earlier, and that is another place you can avoid that. That's those thermal receipts. Every one of those thermal receipts has BPA on them.
When we're looking at trying to improve your hormones, one of the things that you can do is test and not guess. You know, as clinicians, we can guess and not test, or we can test and not guess. And so there are ways that we can test your adrenal hormones with saliva samples. Oftentimes we take 4 saliva samples in one day, in the morning when you get up, at noon, at 5 o'clock, at 10 o'clock at night, and we actually graph your cortisol to see how your cortisol rises and falls over the day to find out a lot more about the health of the adrenal glands. We also measure a compound called DHEA, one of the adrenal hormones that talks to us about how much reserve your adrenals have. Estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, thyroid hormones, All of these things can be measured. When we begin to use measuring tools, most often blood work, with the exception of the cortisol hormones, we are able to then find out where we need to make a difference in terms of supplementing. It's very interesting. I spoke with a young woman this weekend whose physician had recommended that she go on thyroid hormones, even though her numbers were ever so slightly off. And I suggested that before she go on a drug hormone supplementation for her thyroid, that she consider using nutrient supplementation for the thyroid, because the thyroid requires the amino acid tyrosine, the vitamin B6, the minerals zinc and selenium and iodine, and you have to have all of these things together at the same time in order to make thyroid hormones. So sometimes supplementing is the way that you can get the body to make more hormone. You don't necessarily have to use a drug. But when we look at these common presenting complaints, fatigue being one of the more common complaints that I hear of, and Dr. Harvey as well hears in his practice, I have to remember the words of my teacher, Dr. Luke Chalton, who said, don't miss the obvious. I had a client recently who presented with a primary complaint of fatigue, but she had anemia. She was convinced that she had adrenal fatigue, but in fact, that really wasn't the problem. And we did an adrenal test on her and were able to demonstrate with that adrenal test that her adrenals were working just fine. But the problem was anemia. She had become a vegan and she was absolutely not getting enough protein in the diet, enough folate in the diet, enough B12 in the diet. And those were the things that needed to be corrected. It wasn't really a hormonal problem. So testing is one of the ways that you can often get to the bottom of the mystery of the complaint.
So Eve's description of how to deal with the thyroid focused on production, because she was looking at providing supplementation for all the raw materials that the thyroid gland needs to do to produce and synthesize the hormone to be delivered. But on the other end of it, if we're looking at endocrine disruption, mercury can actually bind to proteins and cause the body to recognize the proteins as foreign, resulting in an autoimmune condition. And it's been shown that Hashimoto's thyroiditis, where the body's attacking the thyroid, specifically the thyroid peroxidase enzyme, which is a protein that helps produce the thyroid hormone, that enzyme is being attacked by the body because more than likely it looks foreign because mercury is attached to it at some point. And so the production and distribution could be actually inhibited by this toxicity disrupting the gland's function internally. So detoxification is another method of actually improving gland function, because if we pull the mercury out, the adrenal gland can make its adrenal hormones better, and the thyroid gland can make its thyroid hormones better. So we end up boosting function without having to actually deliver an extra hormone, which is what happens in the interventions often used in Western medicine. You know, when we do the testing, and in my previous practice, when I first learned to be a doctor, I would look at a person's thyroid functions and look at a T4 level, which is the thyroxine, the main hormone, and look at a TSH, and the TSH is thyroid stimulating hormone coming from the pituitary, directing the thyroid to make the hormone. If that TSH was elevated and the T4 was depressed, I would automatically prescribe thyroid hormone. And that's the knee-jerk illness treatment response of the current paradigm that most people are being evaluated by. But if you look deeper and think, why is this TSH elevated? Is there a production problem? Is there not enough nutrient to fulfill the needs of the gland? Is there something interfering with the gland's ability to produce, like mercury interfering with the hormone or the enzyme thyroid peroxidase?
Well, you know, that brings me to the new report that Environmental Working Group just released within the last month, and that was a report on fire retardants. And you go, wait a minute, Eve, that's quite a stretch between fire retardants and thyroid. But it turns out that, you know, back in the 1970s, when fire retardants started being used on upholstery, on the foam that fills up your sofa seat, on the cushion that's on your chair, on your carpeting. We've seen byproducts of fire retardants show up in people's blood, doubling every 5 years since 1972. So over the last 40 years, we're starting to see fire retardants in virtually everybody's blood and everybody's fat. Well, the thing that was frightening about the Environmental Working Group report that came out last month was that they tested a mother and a baby, and they found out that the baby had 5, and hold on to your hats, to 28 times as much fire retardant in their body as the mother did, because we know that it's coming from household dust. That's why the next time you buy a vacuum cleaner, you want to make sure you get a HEPA filter on your vacuum cleaner to try to reduce that dust being recycled in your house. But that dust comes off of the sofa, goes onto the carpet where the baby plays. Baby's crawling around on the carpet, you know, rolling around on the carpet and being exposed to more of that dust, both breathing it in and taking it in through their skin. And so we're contaminating the bodies of people and wildlife all around the planet with these fire retardants. So on the Environmental Working Group site right now is a campaign to try to develop signatures on a petition to ask the federal government to reduce the use of these fire retardants. You know, originally the ruling was passed in California, and they have demonstrated that women in California have more of this fire retardant in their body than any other place in the United States. But because manufacturers didn't want to make one kind of sofa for California and another kind of sofa for the rest of the United States, they started putting fire retardant in all of the foam, in all of the fabric, on all of the carpets. So some drunk fell asleep with a cigarette in their hand and lit themselves up, and that's how these acts came to be. Well, this is something that's virtually impossible to avoid. I wish I knew how to avoid it other than sitting on wood and metal chairs, but we come back to our good old buddy, the absolute 1 micron water filter, to at least try to get it out of the water, and a HEPA vacuum cleaner to try to reduce exposure. You know, it's hard when you make a list like this that says all of these things are potential endocrine disruptors and all of these things you're being exposed to. But if you don't have awareness about it, you don't even know how to begin to avoid some of these things. And there are opportunities to avoid them. And, you know, the biggest one that we have an opportunity to avoid, especially here in the state of Florida, are organophosphate pesticides. Dr. Harvey spoke earlier about atrazine, the pesticide that is commonly used on corn that has created the dead zone along the Mississippi River and in the area in the Gulf just outside of New Orleans. But organophosphate pesticides are the ones that I have the greatest concern about, not only because they alter thyroid levels, but because they alter lots of other hormones in the body. And these are the pesticides that are often used here in this area, both from fruits and vegetables, and that people use in their home and in their yard. You know, if you put a pesticide out in your yard, the sun and the rain can work on it to break it down, or at least part of it. But if you spray it in your house, well, hopefully there's no sun and rain in your house to break it down. We must understand that these things are accumulative in the body. It's not a poisoning per se. It's not a single event. It's a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. But somebody gets out a spray can of some bug killer and, you know, goes and drowns a critter. They don't think anything about the fact that that residue now is in your home. I don't want you to live with bugs. There's lots of other things that you can do to get rid of bugs besides just hygiene. But you really have to consider that when you're spraying these organophosphates and organopesticides in your home and on your lawn, and you're eating them on your fruits and vegetables, you're potentially affecting your hormone reality in your body. So that Dirty Dozen list, that list of the 12 fruits and vegetables that have the highest contamination of pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. Actually, it's up to 14 on that list, but it doesn't sound as cutesy as Dirty Dozen. That list is available on the EWG website. You can print down a wallet card and carry it with you to the market, because if you only bought those 14 fruits and vegetables organically, you would reduce your exposure to organophosphate pesticides and other pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides very significantly by making sure that those 12 or 14 fruits and vegetables don't come into your house unless they're raised organically.
And don't forget the Clean 15. You can save some money looking at those that don't really have those pesticide residues, and you don't have to buy them organically every time. I talked earlier about how progesterone can change the messaging in the cell to induce cell death. Well, one of those hormone disruptors can do the same thing. Phthalates, the plasticizer in plastic number 3, can actually induce that same apoptosis in testicular cells, thus reducing fertility, reducing sperm counts. Another one of those things is the perfluorates. Who hasn't used a non-stick surface cooking pan at some point in their past? 99% of Americans have perfluorates, the non-stick surfaces, in their systems. And in addition, it's used as a water-resistant treatment on carpet and upholstery. So these things are also present everywhere and disrupt the fertility, reducing sperm counts, reducing sperm viability. So again, the way to reduce your exposure is to reduce your exposure to plastics. You want to avoid plastic food containers. You want to avoid PVC plastic wrap and fragrances. Phthalates can hide in that euphemism that the FDA allows in labeling called fragrance. That is really not necessarily fragrance, but just think of it as toxic chemical. If it has that on the label, consider it to be an endocrine disruptor without any, it's guilty until proven innocent. Let's put it that way.
Well, now that we've made you scared of the world, what we want to do is give you a reason to pay more attention. When Doctor and I were in Chicago in June for a conference at one of the fancy hotels, I picked up the little 1 ounce bottle of shampoo that was in the shower, and it had 61 ingredients in it, including phthalates. And so the nature of simple stuff, you know, we wash our hair with this and we rinse our hair with that and we put on this kind of moisturizer and this sort of deodorant and this kind of aftershave. You know, men and women alike use a lot of different products before they ever get out of the bathroom in the morning in terms of something that comes out of a jar or a bottle or a squeeze tube. We want to understand that it's not all on your plate. It's not all in a glass of water. Sometimes the exposure comes from what we use superficially on our skin or what we use as household cleaners. You know, a lot of those fragranced products from the spritzer that you plug into the wall that acts as a room deodorizer to carpet deodorant that you sprinkle on your carpet before you vacuum. All of these things that contain fragrances can contain some of these endocrine disruptors. We have feminized frogs in the world. We have male frogs that actually can grow eggs. We have feminized fish off the coast of California, where there has been so much chemical that has been poured into the oceans, especially on the surfer beaches, that they've actually had ovarian tissue show up in the testicles of the fish. You know, we got to think about that when we're putting these products on our 18-month-old son and wondering if they're getting estrogenic compounds that are going to affect them for the rest of their life. We have to think about that during a pregnancy when we realize that those compounds that we're using can affect the developing fetus. And so awareness is always the first step when it comes to living a more non-toxic life. And once again, you can't separate your personal health from the health of the planet. Every time you go to the market and you buy an organic food, you're sending a message that this is what the American consumer wants more of. You know, we've got a marketplace demand out there, and we've been able to make changes as a result of that marketplace demand. So understand, every time you spend a dollar for an organic food, you're sending a message up the food chain about what you want your future to be. Once again, thanks very much to my guest, Dr. Fred Harvey, geriatrician, internist, and member of the American Board of Holistic Medicine.
I wanted to make a point about that marketplace. When you go into the doctor, if you're seeing a non-functional medicine doctor, a regular medical doctor, and the conversation comes up about hormone replacement therapy, market demand is actually going to drive this economy as well. And so maybe the first question to ask the doctor when he's offering the prescription for hormone is there a reason for my hormone imbalance, and can it be corrected without a hormone prescription? I'd rather reserve that for the last resort.
Good tip. Thanks again, Dr. Harvey, for being our guest here on No Nonsense Nutrition.